Good evening. I'm happy to welcome you to this year's Zukunftskolleg lecture. My name is Klaus Bold. I'm a member of the executive committee in the Zukunftskolleg and a five-year fellow, and I have the honor of doing this short introduction today. The Zukunftskolleg lecture is an event that we use to recognize senior fellows and excellent scientists who have a close connection to the Zukunftskolleg and have supported our Institute of Advanced Research. It has been awarded regularly since 2011 and is given to Professor Vinod Subramaniam this year. And as a sort of return for this honor, which involves a certificate and a little present, we ask the recipient to give a small lecture. And this is why we're here today. So I'm going to introduce Professor Subramaniam quickly. He has studied electrical engineering at Cornell University and finished with his bachelor's degree in 1989. And from then on, he started a career that spans physics and chemistry and biology and shows and demonstrates what an interdisciplinary research area the nanosciences really are. So he did his PhD in applied physics at the University of Michigan on time-resolved spectroscopy of protein folding, and then came to Germany as a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute of Molecular Biology in Göttingen on a human frontier science program postdoc fellowship, where he stayed from 1999 to 2002, then as a staff scientist and group leader. Then for 2 years, from 2002 to 2004, he became a senior research scientist at AstraZeneca Research and Development in the UK, before relocating to the Netherlands, where he became a professor in nanobiophysics at the University of Twente, where he stayed from 2004 to 2016. In the meantime, he also became a scientific director of MIRA, Institute for Biomedical Technology at Twente, and a director of the Foundation for Fundamental Research on Matter in Amsterdam, the AMOLF, from 2013 to 2015. And since 2015, he is acting as Rector Magnificus at the Freie Universität Amsterdam, where he remains today. In addition to that, he has a number of extra appointments: extraordinary professor at Radboud University in Nijmegen from 2011 to 2014, adjunct professor at the Center of Material Sciences in Bangalore, India from 2009 to 2011, and adjunct professor at the School of Natural Sciences in Mumbai. And last but not least, he was a guest professor and senior fellow of the Zukunftskolleg in Konstanz, as part of the Graduate School in Chemical Biology from 2011 to 2016. In his own words, cooperation and learning to speak each other's languages is a core concept of science, and I think you will agree with me that this is a very good choice as a recipient for the Zukunftskolleg Lecture Award. So, as I said, he is going to receive a certificate, and I'm going to read that out before handing over the certificate, a small present. It reads, "The Zukunftskolleg of the University of Konstanz confers on Professor Vinod Subramaniam the honor of giving the Zukunftskolleg lecture to the students and scholars of the University of Konstanz with the title Life's Origami, Protein Folding, Misfolding and Human Diseases. Vinod Subramaniam is Rector Magnificus of the Freie Universität Amsterdam, Konstanz, February 5th, 2018. And then I'm quickly going to grab this. Feels a little bit like adhering to a protocol in the US presidential election.
That's
right. So I hope you can put this somewhere without breaking the flow.
I will try. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And we are very much looking forward to your presentation.
Thank you. You might have to help me with this thing because I can't see the damn thing. Oh, yeah. Is that working? Thank you. Thank you very much. I must admit, I didn't realize that this was such a big deal, that I was going to get a prize and so on. And I must apologize because I was supposed to be here in October, but my wife had surgery and I couldn't leave, so I had to sort of move things around. And I stand here shaven-headed because my wife's hair fell off because of chemotherapy last week, and I'm doing this together with her. We're in it together, so that's the reason why I look not at all like the pictures that the Zukunftskolleg has. So that said, thank you so very much for this honor. It really is an honor to be able to give this lecture here, to be back in Konstanz. I have wonderful memories of the of being here as a senior fellow. I've been here several times, working together with Malte Drescher, but also other people. And I hope that this is not the end of the association and that I will be back more often in the years to come. So I was instructed that I should not give a detailed lecture. I should not go into details. So I'm trying to make this very accessible to potentially the philosophers and the historians and whoever else may be in the audience, but also the biophysicists, because I am a biophysicist, of course. And I wanted to talk about life's origami, and that was the inspiration for this background image that we have, that I didn't pick out. Siggy Elmer was responsible for it. And I wanted to talk about protein folding, misfolding, human diseases, and at some point I'm going to stop and challenge you about the way we do science. Yeah? So proteins are really the nanometer scale machinery of life. And this is a movie that is from the Harvard Molecular Cell Biology Department. And it's fantastic because you actually see these, you know, kinesin motor proteins sort of walking along on the actin cytoskeleton. But what you should look at is look at the beautiful structure that's associated with this. These things are in a particular shape. You know, the rails are built out of a certain, they have a particular shape. These motor proteins are walking along like this. How did they end up being like this? And I think Klaus mentioned the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry in Göttingen, and one of the things I did there was work on homeodomains. And the homeodomain is a canonical DNA binding domain. Yeah? And this is one of these images that really illustrates the concept of a correlation of structure and function. And here you see this homeodomain, which has this helix. That was not what I wanted to do. This helix, which just nestles into the major groove of the DNA, where the contact is mediated by this lysine residue, so you have an electrostatic contact. And this tail of the protein sort of wraps around back into the minor groove as if it's a dancer holding his or her partner. You know, these wonderful structures that are formed, they don't just sort of happen in a 3D printing process or something like that. They have evolved to actually form these shapes, and we have no idea how that works. And that is actually sort of fascinating as being a scientist, because you want to understand how do these things happen. Now, I want to illustrate this notion of the structure function paradigm with a very commonplace object. This is a paperclip, right? You have all seen paperclips. You have all used paperclips. Paperclips only work if they are like this. Because if you have something like this, the paperclip simply does not work. Proteins, to a large extent, are like that. They require to be in a certain structure to be actually able to do the function that they were designed to do. But as I said, proteins are not formed in these three-dimensional structures. They are spit out of a ribosome as a linear chain of amino acids. So it's just sort of a pearl necklace. I borrowed that from my wife. So how does it happen that these things come off as a linear chain of amino acids? And how do they end up in these fantastically three-dimensional structures, for the most part? Because there are some proteins that don't always fold properly or fold, you know, partially. But for the most part, how do they end up into these structures that are holding the DNA or walking on actin? How does that work? And that's the sort of thing that's been, you know, keeping me busy for the last 20 years or so. Although, you know, you follow a path saying, oh, you want to study protein folding, and all of a sudden you realize it's too hard and you find something else and it's protein misfolding. So the idea is, and this is where that notion of the origami idea came up, because what you do is you start with this piece of paper, and with a few deft folds of the paper, you have a wonderful structure, in this case the origami bird. So how do you go from this chain of amino acids to something like this? You know, this is a structure I want to tell you. This is something I made myself when this is kind of corny, actually. Yeah, 1995, 96. It was something that the first time that you started to get programs that actually do 3D visualization, and that was the time when the PDB had, I think, 10 or 15 entries. You know, there's a few thousand entries now. And so I was fiddling around with this thing and making a picture for my thesis. And so this is an original from a long time ago. Yeah? It means nothing, but the point is, how do you go from here to that? Yeah, and look at the structure, look at the beauty of that structure. You know, how do these things end up in these structures? What forces drive the protein to go from this linear chain of polymers to a structure, a well-defined structure? So as Klaus pointed out, I have a bit of a training in physics, and so you can think about it from a physical perspective and say, ah, this is all free energy, right? So what you do is you start at a state of extremely high free energy, the entropy, you want to try to reduce the free energy. So any system will just try to go to the lowest state of free energy. And if you think about this as a funnel, then you have these unfolded proteins, or you have the chain of amino acids, and then it starts to rattle down the free energy funnel, and in between it starts to pick up sort of structure, and this is partial structures. And if you're lucky, it's going to end up in the global thermodynamic minimum, and it's going to be out here, and it's the protein in the structure that you think it's going to be. This is great. Seems to work. But, there's an astronomical number of possibilities. And so what actually defines the funnel and what comes down there? So these are questions that you could ask, and you could spend the next 20 years thinking about and trying to figure out and model. But it's very interesting to think about. Now, if proteins can fold, they can also unfold. And I use my origami example. I can just unfold this thing and I can iron it out, and I have a flat sheet of paper, right? Now, I had this for breakfast this morning. I had a fried egg. And those of you who eat a fried egg for breakfast are actually basically involved in a protein unfolding experiment. You are unfolding the protein, because what you did was thermally, you did a thermal heat-induced unfolding of the proteins in the egg. Only this is an irreversible process. This process up here, I can go back and forth till the cows come home, So this is forever. This, it's game over after you've done this. Yeah, you just eat it and then that's it. Now, so from the free energy perspective, what actually ended up happening was you went from here and you went up there somewhere, and then you went off scale, you went off somewhere else because it, all those proteins basically aggregated, and then you ended up in a very deep minimum, which is so deep that you can't get out of it, right? That's the whole point. That's what happens in the in that unfolding process. Now, if you think about the human body and you think about the number of proteins that we have, and you think about the fact that, you know, the ribosomes are basically spitting out multiple millions of copies of the proteins, there's a lot of and it is unrealistic to think that the protein machinery is going to be 100% accurate. It doesn't work all the time. Nothing in life works that way. The stuff goes wrong all the time. But the body has actually, the cell has figured out a way to deal with this. And what the cell does is, if it finds and detects that protein is misfolding or is not quite correctly folded, it has a whole recycling system set up. Yeah? And basically, it will chop up the protein that is misfolded and recycle the components. It also has helper molecules. It has molecules like molecular chaperones, which recognize the fact that a protein is misfolded or misfolding and tries to help the protein sort of go back on the path of the good and righteous. Yeah? But that doesn't happen all the time. What also, I give you an example here. I mean, in a normal process, it goes wrong all the time, and then, you know, the body just deals with it. Sometimes you have situations where things go really wrong. Yeah, you have a mutation, and in that case, and I take the example here of a protein which is actually just the nuclear binding domain of a very large protein called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance channel protein. And there's one amino acid that's deleted. There's a phenylalanine at position 508. And the fact that I'm talking about position 508 should tell you this is a humongous protein. It's a very large protein. Yeah? And this one deletion means that the protein misfolds. The chloride, this is a chloride channel, and the channel basically doesn't work. The rest of it folds. All right, but there's this one single amino acid deletion, and that leads to disease, and that leads to the disease cystic fibrosis. And some of you may know people who have this disease. Some of you may have heard of it. You may have also heard about I come from the Netherlands. There has been a huge discussion over the last year about the price of the treatment that has been made for cystic fibrosis and for this Delta 508 mutation. It's about 200,000 euros a year, and whether it should be in the insurance packet or not. So this has been front and center in the news in the last year or so. There are many such examples. In the P53 protein, in the core domain, single mutations, those are hotspot mutations that cause cancer. Yeah? So things go wrong. So if you go back to this free energy perspective, basically, so let's think about my fried egg. The fried egg started, actually the egg started here. I fried it and it went up here and it fell into this deep structure or deep minimum. And it couldn't really come back. And what I was saying is that you have these helper molecules, the chaperones, which will slowly nudge the thing back over to this minimum. But there are also other states that seem to form, and there seems to be a state that forms that is even much deeper than the in terms of energy than the fried egg. And that's something that's called the amyloid state. Now, for a long time, amyloid has been around for a very long time, yeah? Alzheimer, 150, 200 years ago, saw the first sort of, you know, these first signs of amyloid. And it was called amyloid because it's a starch-like substance which colors red with an appropriate dye which hits starchy stuff. But what is amyloid? So it turns out that this is a state which more and more proteins appear to be able to get into and can't get out of. So let's talk about that. I want to focus then on one class of diseases, and that's the neurodegenerative diseases. And these are diseases such as Alzheimer's, as I just mentioned, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease. There's the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, big words, don't worry about it, mad cow disease, that sort of thing, yeah? Prion diseases. What characterizes all of these diseases is that in the healthy state, you have the neurons making these sorts of connections. In the disease state, you see extracellular aggregates or intracellular aggregates, which have a certain form. And it turns out, if you look very carefully, and now this is a sample from the brain of a patient who died from Parkinson's disease, and if you then stain it against an antibody for a protein called alpha-synuclein, you see these structures, and these structures are called Lewy bodies or Lewy neurites. This is a Lewy body, this is a Lewy neurite. And if you zoom in, and when I say zoom in, I mean zoom in by, this is really macroscopic scale. This is, you know, centimeter scale. This is a micron by a micron. Yeah, so you're zooming in really millions of times. What you end up seeing is that these structures are full of these sorts of structures, these fibrillar structures, thread-like structures. Yeah, and these thread-like structures, they're about 10 nanometers in diameter. Now, I know very few things that I can actually compare to say, well, you know, so it's a millionth of a millionth the width of your hair, but my hair, I can't really show very much of it right now, but it's really very small. You can't see it, yeah? So we'll also talk about how do you actually go about seeing it. So you might ask the question, if you can't see it, how the hell do you make that picture? I'll tell you, yeah? Okay, so what is amyloid? These are insoluble fibrillar protein aggregates that share a couple of structural traits, and they have the so-called cross beta sheet structure. And that is that these threads, these fibrils, they have a certain axis, and you have beta sheets that are formed of stacked beta strands, which are parallel or anti-parallel, doesn't matter, depends on the protein. And these things are orthogonal to the direction of the fibril. And all of these proteins, and this is the fascinating thing, you know, it can be a peptide, which is a tripeptide or a hexapeptide, or it can be a protein like alpha-synuclein, which is 140 amino acids. It can be tau, which is 440 amino acids. They all make fibrils which have this type of structure and which have approximately 10 nanometers, give or take 5 nanometers, yeah, width of the structures. So you ask the question, how can that happen? How can that happen that you have proteins that are of such vastly different chemical composition, such vastly different size? How can they make the same structure when it all goes wrong? All right? This is cool. It is also exceedingly scary. Right? But you ask the question saying, how does this happen? We don't know the answer. I can give you that for free now, but I will tell you a few things about it. Okay. The other thing that you should know is that amyloids are ubiquitous. They're all around us. They're pathological amyloids, such as what happens in disease, and that's in all these neurodegenerative diseases. But you can also get them in your gut, in your heart, in all kinds of other organs with all kinds of other proteins. You eat fish. If you eat codfish, for example, that comes out of the North Sea, then there's a protein called parvalmubin in codfish. And this codfish parvalmubin lives in the fish as an amyloid, because as it goes through the gut of the fish, it doesn't get digested. Yeah, so parvalbumin, this is an amyloid form. We have hormones. The pMEL17 hormone, which is stored in our bodies in the form of amyloids, and it's basically a slow release mechanism, so that, you know, over our lifetime, in the amyloid form, it releases that hormone very slowly. So we've all got it. In good forms, sometimes we have it in bad form. There's also functional amyloid food proteins. I, of course, come from the land of cheese, right? And a lot of cheese proteins are in amyloid form. Yeah. Peptide hormone storage, I've already talked about. And bacterial adhesion, you talk about biofilms, the stuff that grows on the lakes. Hopefully the Bonaceae doesn't have it, the green algae that forms, and you get bacterial biofilms. That's amyloid, curly. Any of you sailors out here? Now, you get these things, barnacles that stick to the side of your boat. Very hard to take off, these little mollusk-like stuckers. You know why? The glue that they secrete, that's an amyloid. And amyloid, which is, if you actually look at the mechanical properties of amyloid, it is stronger than steel. Okay? And that's the reason why cleaning the side of your boat is a thankless task. Okay. So to go back to this question, how is it possible that what are the physical forces that drive these vastly different proteins to misfold and to self-assemble into these similar structures? And, you know, I show you a couple of examples here. This is a tripeptide. This is work from the Hauser group. This is work from my own group from a long time ago. And this is a very recent paper from Jülich and Düsseldorf, where my first PhD student was involved in it, so I'm very proud of it, yeah, where they have the first cryo-electron structure of A-beta 1 to 42 fibrils. And you can see all of these things. They look exactly the same. Completely different proteins, yeah? Three amino acids, 42, 140. How does that happen? Yeah. The funny thing is, if you think about aggregation, you start with one protein, right? And then you say it's aggregating, then the first thing that has to happen is that one and one have to come together, so you get a dimer. But these fibrils have millions of proteins, so... And the road from here to there is paved with many different structures. Yeah. So if you think about it, there's all kinds of possibilities to go from here to here. And this is a schematic that Dave Talaga at Rutgers made a long time ago, and it's still relevant. And the challenge, of course, is trying to figure out what are all of these species, what do they do, in the cell, what do they do individually, so on and so forth. And you need a whole battery of techniques to look at them. My lab has focused in the last few years on this protein. It's human alpha-synuclein. I don't want to go into much detail about it. It's a small protein. It's intrinsically disordered. It's 140 amino acids. We don't know what it does. I'll come back to that, why we don't know what it does. What we do know is that it's found as the main component of pathological amyloid in these cells of Parkinson's disease brains. Okay? So if you do an aggregation schematic, I mean, if you make this stuff, you make a bag of this protein and you just, let it aggregate in the lab, And you measure it by the techniques that we know how to measure it. And basically what happens is that you see nothing for the first, in this case, 40 hours, 2 days, nothing happens. And then it all of a sudden it takes off and then it saturates. Yeah. So in physical terms, this is called a nucleation polymerization reaction. But this would suggest that nothing's happening. But that's nonsense, of course. Yeah. I mean, that just means that we haven't figured out ways to measure what's happening out there. So by most techniques that we have, we don't know how to see these structures because they are nanoscale structures. Yeah, and you'd say, okay, well, throw an electron microscope at it. Hard to do that when it's in solution. Yeah. So we have to find other ways to visualize this, and so. So there's some members of this audience who will recognize this picture. This is an LP and a record player. Now, I understand that the latest generation is rediscovered vinyl, so maybe the young ones here recognize it as well. But I grew up with these sorts of things. And the way this works is that you have a diamond needle that basically follows the grooves of the record. Yeah, so basically what you're doing is you're feeling the surface of the LP, and that's then getting translated into an electrical signal, which then gets translated into sound. So what we do to look at these nanoscale structures is the nanometer scale equivalent of the LP. So we feel them. We don't photograph them, we don't look at them, we try to feel them. All right? And if you have really tiny structures and you have a needle that's tinier than those structures or about the same size, then you can feel it. And if you do it smart, and you know, this is a technological atomic force microscopy that was invented, you know, 50 miles up the road, 50 kilometers up the road in Zurich, the IBM Ruschlikon labs. So it works. So these are the sorts of needles we use. These are on the structures are on the order of a couple of nanometers, 10 nanometers. So that's on the ballpark of the size of the fibrils. And then if you use this to look at it, you look at this part of the structure and you say, well, it's actually, there's a lot of stuff in there. There's a whole zoo of little animals out there. And these animals are, you know, spherical aggregates about 5 nanometers in diameter. These are about 1 nanometer sheet-like structures or mixtures of the two. Yeah. So you can actually find all kinds of structures out there, and then we simply can't measure it with most techniques that we have. Now, the funny thing is that my lab, other labs, and this is the lab of Ratnesh Lal, looked at amyloids from a bunch of different proteins, and they saw structures which looked like this. Looks like a hole. It looks like a donut, you know. And then you say, if it's a donut, if it's a donut-like structure, maybe it can punch a hole into something, right? And so, you know, I was challenging my PhD students, and if it looks like a donut, does it smell like a donut, you know, can it taste like a donut, you have to do the experiments, yeah? Does it work like a donut, right? And so how do you do that? If it works like a donut, then the donut should insert into a membrane. So you think about this. If you think about the cell as just a balloon, which for the most part it is, with a membrane, which is the outside of the balloon, and if these oligomeric structures are donuts, then they should punch a hole, maybe, into the membrane. And basically what you're doing is you're pricking it, and then that should either make the cell collapse or stuff goes in, stuff goes out. So you could ask now, I see Martin Stockel here, and I want to... Martin was a postdoc with me a few years ago, and he made this figure. So I made sure I brought it up here because I was hoping he'd be in the audience. So Martin made this figure, and he says, well, look, there's a couple of mechanisms that you could have to look at how proteins, these amyloid structures might interact with the membranes. It may be this kind of pore-like mechanism. Or they could just grow on the membrane and start chewing it up and membrane thinning. This has been seen for insulin, and you end up making a mess of this. Yeah? And that way you damage the cell. So we tested this, and we tested this by sort of making the nanoscale equivalent of a balloon. We made unilamellar vesicles, which are about 120 nanometers in diameter. We filled them with calcium, which is a dye, yeah, which self-quenches. And if you punch a hole in it, the stuff should leak out, and then you see a fluorescent signal. And by golly, it works. So if you do this, you see that, you know, if you add just the monomeric protein, it leaks. Fibrils also leak, but these oligomeric structures make it leak even better, even faster. So it looks like it works. Yeah, we could also visualize this to some extent. We made giant unilamellar vesicles, and we do an experiment where we have a fluorescent dye in, and it'll start again, and then we throw the oligomers in there, and all of a sudden, boom, the stuff's gone. Yeah, so something, it's punching holes in these balloons, if you will, and the stuff is leaking out. All right, what you should keep in mind is that these are intact, they keep going on. You know, the balloons seem to be happily floating further. So membrane thinning may not be happening. Yeah, we don't know. All right, because now I'm going to show you something that says, what we did was, you know, this is work that we did very recently, and we looked at supported lipid bilayers, because we'd say if you have something that's small and it sees in a cell a membrane, as far as a small oligomer is concerned, the membrane surface in front of you is the flat earth, you know, it is as huge. So looking at, you know, curved vesicles probably doesn't make sense, so we went to supported lipid bilayers. And if you have supported lipid bilayers which are defect-free, nothing happens. This is the lipid channel. These are defect-free supported lipid bilayers, and the stuff, you put the proteins on there, and it just sort of sits there. But if these bilayers have defects, which are these black holes here, and then you throw the protein on there, well, they start to collect along here, and they form fancy patterns. And if you look at this, you know, 20 years ago it was a hype to look at fractal patterns, Mandelbrot sets, and so on. These guys are fractals. And so if you look now with the atomic force microscope, and we look at it over a function of time, 1.5 hours, you add the protein, they start to actually, it collects in the defects, and then all of a sudden it starts to suck lipid out from the neighboring regions, and it forms these damage patterns. And these patterns are all fractal in nature. Okay, so what does that mean? Does that mean we have pores, or does it mean we have membrane thinning? And this is the fun part of science. We don't know. It could be both, yeah? Okay. And then what you do with this kind of atomic force microscopy, you can actually really look at the details of the structure, the morphology. And I just show you three different fibrils out here. And you should be able to see things with a twist here, and you can see these twisted things here. You look on a bigger scale, you see these twisted fibrils, but you also see fibrils which are not twisted. This one, no twist. What's going on, right? There's some polymorphism out here. And so you ask the question, why is fibril polymorphism important? It turns out that this is true for all amyloids, yeah? This is true for all of the diseases that we have found that have amyloid. There's fibril polymorphism. The structures are different. And maybe it means it has to do with differentiation of toxic species. So the ones that are twisted more may be more toxic than the ones that are less twisted. And then you ask the question, do the variations in molecular structures play a role in disease development or presentation? Open question. It's something, because what you see is that there is no one type of Parkinson's disease or one type of Alzheimer's disease. Yeah? The problem, of course, is that you cannot correlate a patient presentation with the molecular structure, because you can't get to this stuff until the patient has died. All right? It's not, you can't really see it. Could there be differential effect of drugs on different polymorphs? Yeah? Do drugs work differently? And if one polymorph is, for example, the toxic one, and your drug actually makes other polymorphs turn into the killer, your drug isn't really doing what it should be doing. Yeah. So those are questions that one needs to ask. And obviously, as a fundamental scientist, I ask the question, does it give me a clue towards intervening in the aggregation process? Yeah, and those are the sorts of questions you might want to ask. Now, Ashdeep Sidhu in my lab looked at one type of protein, the wild-type alpha-synuclein, and she found something spectacular. So these are the fibrils that she made. She spent a year and a half making homogeneous fibrils. And in this sample, you can see these three different fibrils here, and you see these structures. And the same bucket of sample we followed for a year. And 7 days, you see the fibrils have changed. Now, it looks like these are only two fibrils. Don't worry, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. Statistically, it is completely solid. 3 months later, you don't have these sorts of twisted fibrils. You get sort of wavy fibrils forming. 6 months later, there are non-periodic and wavy fibers. So what's going on here? What's happening is that the fibrils in the same sample are evolving over a period of time. All right? So you're getting a sort of annealing of the structure over the period of time. And we followed this now for a year. Graduate students, you know, finish their PhDs and leave. You know, maybe if we look at it after a couple of years, we may see another structure. But think about what's happening in your brain. You're there. The stuff is in your brain for sometimes 20 years. All right, so there's all kinds of stuff evolving. Structures are changing and evolving, and maybe that plays a role. Now, these are in vitro experiments that have nothing to do with the in vivo case, but the fact that you can observe something like this makes you think about what might be happening in the brain. So if I go back to this free energy structure, well, I just said that, you know, it looks like the amyloid is sort of the deepest minimum that you could find. So once you're in the amyloid case, nothing happens. You never come out of it. But what I just showed you suggests that there's actually a ruggedness to the landscape over here, that the bottom of this valley is actually somewhat more rugged, and that you're actually getting an annealing from this to this to this to this, which actually has, and each one of those are very close to each other but have different structures, and they don't appear to be coming back. So actually, this looks like this is a downhill process going from sort of twisted fibrils to some kind of non-periodic fibrils. Fascinating. We don't know enough about it to say exactly what's happening, but this seems to be going on here. All right. And then because Malte Drescher is here, I have to say, you know, I came into contact with Constanz through Malte Drescher, who I met about, I'm trying to figure out, 11 years ago now? Yeah. And it led to, this was one of the first papers that we had together. There was a Jack's paper, which has looked at the structure, the horseshoe structure of the protein. We tried to figure out what was the structure of this protein on vesicles, you know. And this is a controversy in the field, will remain a controversy in the field, because we swear it's a horseshoe structure. Other people swear it's an extended structure, but that's okay, you know. That's what makes this protein a chameleon, all right? On the other hand, there's a couple of other very good labs that agree with our structure. So, you know, I think we're right. Yeah. And we have the best experimenter here. But that's not what I... So a little aside there. Yeah. Why I think EPR is important is that because it gives us a chance to go into the cell, in a cellular system, to look at it, which other techniques don't really allow us to do. We've done some preliminary work, or Malte's really done most of our work. And it looks like you can get signals and look at conformations inside the cell, which is very cool. Yeah, you can't do it in a human head yet, but Maybe we don't need to. I now want to stop and go to a completely different perspective. I've given you a flavor of the sorts of things that have made me, kept me off the streets, kept me happy over the last 20 years. I downloaded this data yesterday, okay? As of last night, there were 9,003 papers on alpha-synuclein. I did a search alpha-synuclein in PubMed, 9,003. We are on the 5th of February. There are 151 papers this year, all right? We have no idea what this protein does. You laugh, and that is a good response. But on the other hand, just think about it. There are 9,000 papers on this protein. We have no clue what it does. We are blindly seeking in the dark to some extent, you know, trying to figure out everything. But this is what science is about. You know, you try to figure out bits and pieces, but we haven't found the answer yet. Now, let me give you another number that should put things into perspective. Yeah? There are about 9 million patients with Parkinson's disease. That's three orders of magnitude more than the number of papers that we have written on this. What do we do with them? Yeah. We don't have a cure. We can address some symptoms, but we have no cure. We have early diagnostics, okay? And you can diagnose certain diseases very early. And as Giovanni pointed out, all of a sudden, this is a great success for the pharmaceutical industry because you live longer. You die at the same age, but you knew that you have the disease 5 years earlier because your diagnostic was earlier. But think about the issue in this way. Yeah? If I have an early diagnostic for a disease that we have no cure for, it's an ethical question. How do we go about that discussion? How do we have that discussion about saying, do you really want to know? Do I want to know if my 10-year-old daughter has a gene for a disease that I cannot cure or we cannot cure? I tell you, as a dad, I don't want to know, I think. But as a scientist, there's a part of me that says, yeah, I do want to know. But why am I saying this? I'm saying this because I firmly believe that institutions like the Zukunftskolleg are needed to bring together people, you know, the philosophers and the historians and the biophysicists and the chemists and the biologists to sit together and not work on the same problem, but to talk about the problems that you're working on. To exchange these sorts of ideas, these perspectives from different, we call it in Dutch invalshoeken. So, you know, which angle do you take it? You know, which perspective do you take on this? It's extremely important to do that. This is the role of a university, right? I mean, that's why you have broad universities that have humanities and the natural sciences and the social sciences, because you have different perspectives on problems that are of great societal relevance. Yeah? And it doesn't matter that I'm working on one tiny bit of that puzzle as a biophysicist and the philosophers thinking about something else. But I think what's important is the dialogue between the two, the different disciplines, to say, hey, what do we do with these sorts of wicked problems, real-world problems? And on that note, I'd like to end. I'd like to thank a lot of people. I have a whole team of students, colleagues, and collaborators over the years. There's a whole bunch of people who gave us bags of money to do some of the work. Not enough, but they did give us some, yeah. I'd like to thank the Zukunftskolleg, the course, Constance Research School, Chemical Biology, and the University of Constance for giving me the opportunity to have been a part of that interaction and that dialogue. And thank you all for your attention and for listening to me.
We have, I think, time for questions.
Why is it so difficult to find out the function of alpha-synuclein? Is it actually essential for humans?
It's kind of interesting. Yeah? I mean, we have about as much this. We have about 1% of neurons. The protein content is alpha-synuclein. Now you can't do a knockout experiment on humans. Yeah, so we haven't done that. We've done knockout experiments on mice. They live happily ever after. Yeah, but those are mice. Yeah, you stick human alpha-synuclein gene into mice or into Drosophila, they exhibit symptoms of Parkinson's disease. You know, they start trembling. They don't crawl up the walls. So it does something. We just don't know what. And beats me. I'm not a biologist. We've tried everything. We have no idea what the function is. Yeah? And the fact may be that it has many functions. Yeah, the whole fact that it is disordered could mean that it's promiscuous in its interactions and that it's very difficult to say that it does one thing.
You now have a very nice way to look at these artifacts and on these fibrils. Could any of these methods be implemented for high throughput screening? For example, for substances that get rid or destroy these fibrils?
You could. There are some ways. I mean, atomic source microscopy is very hard to do in a high throughput fashion, but there's a guy up in Basel who's doing that. Yeah, so Daniel Müller does very nice semi high throughput. But look, you know, at some point you could do some, but it's not really high throughput because those sorts of images, I mean, at those resolutions, it takes a half an hour to make a good image. You know. If you do a 96 well plate, that's okay, yeah. But if you want to do stacks of, plates, then it gets a bit harder, yeah. But it's not yet ready for high throughput screening. Not the atomic force microscopy, but there's other ways to look at it. Super resolution microscopy, maybe you could do. Martin can help you there. Yeah. Bioimaging center, support it.
So you have shown in your free energy panel that for the different conformations of the fibrils, there are energetically similar minima. Why would you expect to have one defined form in the beginning and then later again other defined conformations?
It's a mystery. I mean, I don't have an answer to that. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think part of it is that it comes from let's put it this way. I think it comes from a very simplistic view when we started, which is to say that you basically just have a simple funnel, yeah? And you start up here and you go plonk down to the minimum, the thermodynamic minimum, and there's nothing in between. But that's nonsense, because that's where the whole concept of rugged energy landscapes that Peter Wollanus and everyone came up with. And then you see that, let's put it this way, I think it's because nature is a damn sight more complex than we actually think it is. Yeah. I think that's the real answer. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a certain hubris that we have as human beings and scientists saying we can explain all of this, and it's nature's way of saying, no way, that's on video too. I don't know if I should have done that. Yeah.
I don't know what that is supposed to be, Thomas.
Does this aging of the fibrils that you showed over the month, yeah, does that correlate with like some oxidation of the proteins, or is the protein of these old fibrils still the same, basically?
So we did some mass spec on that, and it's exactly the same. But that doesn't necessarily mean that nothing happened to the protein. Yeah. To the best of our knowledge, to the best that we have been able to interrogate it, nothing's really happened to the protein.
Do these various structures have any effect on cell death?
So, That's a very good question. We have tried it. So what we see is that in sort of in vitro approaches, you know, with these vesicles and all of that, we can clearly see in our hands, with the cell lines we use, we didn't see very much. Yeah. But what we've also seen is that this seems to be a problem with the whole amyloid cell death structure sort of assays. Yeah. What most people are doing is adding these structures to the cells and saying, okay, do they die? Yeah. And it turns out that the depending on the labs and the exact protocols that you're using, you get different results. So that's an unreliable measure at this point. And our hands were not very good with cells, so we've had not very good luck with it. The other question we asked was also, does it make sense to look at alpha-synuclein added extracellularly, because this is an intracellular protein that aggregates intracellularly? Turns out that there seems to be cell-to-cell transmission as well, so it may also work in an extracellular fashion, but it's a lot more complex than that. A very short answer to your very simple question: no, in our hands, we've not been able to see it in cell assays, but others have.
Okay. Last question in that direction. You mentioned this long-term experiment. Yeah. You just sort of leave the stuff and it evolves, and you observe different things in the course of months.
Yeah.
Do you see some sort of cyclic behavior that you get the same sequence of patterns or structures after, say, 2 years or something like that?
We followed it for about a year and a half, and then bacteria started to grow in this stuff, so we couldn't do very much with the proteins. Yeah, in that period of time, about a year and a half, we didn't see any cyclic behavior. All right, so we had azide and all that stuff, but stuff got contaminated. So it's worth trying, but we've not seen anything over that time scale. We've not seen.
Based on this question, or touching on this question, in the long-term experiments, do all the fibrils have the same starting point, the same starting structures, or do they all have different ones, and do they age differently?
So we worked very hard to start with a homogeneous population. So that was that 1.5 years I said, you know, my PhD student worked on. So we worked on a series of making generations where you're starting with a starting structure which is, to the extent possible, homogeneous. Yeah. But does that rule out that there are differences in the structures? I've shown you everything. Everything is possible with these structures, so I can't rule it out. Yeah. We think that we are starting, to the extent possible, with a single structure.
You already mentioned that alpha-synuclein is intrinsically disordered. Is there any modification or forces alpha-synuclein in the structure as a monomer?
So I mean, there are some post-translational modifications, that may cause it. I mean, the thing that absolutely forces it into a structure as a monomer is binding to a lipid. If you present it to a lipid, it'll form alpha helical structure. That's that I can guarantee. Other sorts of post-translational modifications intrinsically forming structure, I don't know of. Yeah. But that's what we see with monomers, is that you throw a bag of lipids in there and you have helical structure.
Okay, I was actually correct. We do have 7. So I have actually one question. You used the word evolution of these fibrils. So do you always end up with the same outcome when the fibrils evolve? Or is there some sort of selection process going on that they may direct themselves into a certain direction until it's a sort of self-amplified reorganization process?
that may end up with different schemes every time you look at them.
So I probably shouldn't have used that word evolution because I have no evidence to think that there is any selection or whatever going on. Yeah, I think what you do see is that you're getting some kind of, you know, annealing of the structure, which is, but that's probably not evolution. I used it loosely in the literary, meaning, but rather than not in the scientific context. Yeah.
Is there any process which would break down these large amyloid chains?
It turns out that there are some processes that you can do, but that requires, hydrolyzing the whole thing at, very low pHs. You can break them up by, sonicating and that sort of stuff, but they are exceedingly robust. So, most things that you would do under normal circumstances, nothing happens. You can boil the suckers, nothing will happen.
When you look at, spider webs, like that, then the spiders apparently have got enzymes or some other mechanism to sort of dissolve.
So we've tried all kinds of things with proteinases to see if you can chop it up, but it turns out that when they're in that structure, there's very little that actually can, make a dent.
So that means the molas sticking on the bottom of your ship is not going to be able to detach itself. It has to die out.
That probably is what is going to happen. Yeah. Although I think, I probably have a friend who's working on anti-fouling techniques who says, I have some other things that will get it off. Thank you.